Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Oh, You podcast. Today, we have an extra special guest from Kashrus, from the beginnings of Kashrus here at the OU, Rabbi Luban, who's been with us for a couple of years, right?
Kashrus started in 1927, I think.
Yeah.
I'm not that old.
You're not that old? You weren't here right at the beginning?
No.
Okay. But you've been with us for...
Almost 40 years.
Almost 40 years. We're thinking about starting a new society, the Lamites Melachas Society, okay. Right? Lamites, 39 years so far. Okay? Should continue to be with strength and even moving on in life.
Thank you.
We know that you've been an important part of the OU and wanted to talk a little bit about that here today. So thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We really we appreciate you. We appreciate lots of good stories, hopefully, that we'll hear. But first of all, why don't you start by telling us a little bit about yourself? Where are you from? Who are you?
So I, till the age of 8, I grew up in Holyoke, Massachusetts. My father was the rabbi in a shul in Holyoke. From the age of 15, I was away in yeshivas. I attended Philadelphia yeshiva for the last 2 years of high school, and then I was in Beis Medrash in Philadelphia. Then I spent a year in the Mir. In those days, almost no Americans went to Israel, surprisingly.
Yeah.
I was the only one in my class that went to Israel. It was a terrific experience for me. But I had the tremendous schus to learn by Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, who was the Rosh Yeshiva. And I always felt that it was Hashgacha Pratis, divine providence, because at the time I didn't know I was going to become a rabbi, but as a rabbi, having been in the Mir and seen Rav Chaim and heard his shmuzin, that had a tremendous impact on me.
You had a personal relationship growing up, not just with your family, in the neighborhood. There was another young man who you were friends with.
Rabbi Ganak.
Rabbi Menachem Ganak,
yes.
The very same.
Yeah,
right?
We were neighbors.
Amazing.
We played Ringo Livio.
I'm not sure.
The audience doesn't know what it's some kind of running game.
Okay, maybe you'll teach us. We can we could have rallies here at the what's it called?
Ringo Livio.
Ringo Livio.
Yeah.
And for any of our listeners, if you know what that is, you can phone in.
If you
and
Google
get a,
it,
a raffle.
You'll find out.
Okay. So you leave the Mir.
I left the Mir after a year. I went to Lakewood. I stayed 10 years in Lakewood. And then
10 years.
Then I became a rabbi, but in between, I spent 3 years in Pittsburgh, and that was a very important point of transition for me because I spent a lot of time working with people in the community, delivering shiurim, and then became the rabbi of a small little shul in Edison, New Jersey, which Baruch Hashem has grown. And concurrent with that, a year later, I started working for the OU.
So you came back, you started working in Edison,
I started as a rabbi. I spent 1 year as a teaching in yeshiva. I was a complete failure because I'm not a disciplinarian. As I stood there staring at the kids the first day, they climbed out of the window. They tied a bunch of rags together and they used it as a ladder to go out. And my stare wasn't scary. So,
interesting that you say you're not a disciplinarian. Some of the stories that we'll get into being involved with OU Kashrus has forced you, I think, to become more...
A detective, not a disciplinarian.
Okay. So when you started in 1984...
Correct.
How many other employees were there in Kashrus full-time?
One. Mati Grunberg. The OU was tiny. There were about 1,000 companies, but the staff was very small. When I started, there were no computers.
So how did you keep track of all the ingredients and the companies and the pieces of paper?
With paper.
So were you involved in putting together the structures and the systems that we have today?
One of the first things that I had the good fortune of working on was developing a computer system. It took us from horse and buggy to the modern age.
So horse and buggy to the modern age. So that's not just in one leap, right?
It was a long process.
Walk us through what you did in order to get us to where we are today.
Well, the key was organization. There was very little structure when I came. We had all these files, and the file could have 500 pieces of paper because it had all the correspondence. It was a very, very difficult experience to manage the kashrus without a structure.
Was there a sense of what the kashrus was? Did we know? Did we follow the same halachos in every?
Yeah. There was a basic system for kashrus. It's simple. If you know the ingredients and they're all kosher, then you have a mashiach who visits the plant and makes sure that they're using those ingredients, and you know what products they're manufacturing. So that's the whole system. But there's so many pieces and elements and the details that make that up. So but you have to have a way of managing it.
But you also reached out to some senior rabbanim to ask them a lot of shailas in terms of laying some of that framework down, right?
So Rabbi Gnack hired the two poskim were Rabbi Belsky, Zichron Uvracha, and Rabbi Shachter. I don't remember who came first. And we started to have weekly meetings with both of them together. I created an agenda of shailos, like the aleph base. What temperature is Yatzaledes? How do you kasher this type of piece of equipment? Things that
we have notes still from those conversations.
I have some notes. Yes.
Combined with your amazing writing skills, that would be an interesting.
We had in the early days staff meetings once a week where we discussed policies. And I took notes at every meeting, and those notes are very valuable. I donated them to the archives here. I don't know where they are, but
okay.
And we have thousands of shilos that are recorded. Some of the psukim are written by Rabbi Belsky or Yibad Ol Chaim by Rabbi Shachter. Others were written by the Rabbi Gersten or his predecessors, and that's a tremendous resource that we have now.
Yep.
So but when I came, nothing was in writing. There was nothing recorded. It was just shooting in the dark.
So really, you've had a chance to see the OU grow from original days of not so many employees, not so many computers, not so many systems and structures. Right. Could you ever have imagined, sort of what's going on around us here? Even today, with all the activity and action,
unbelievable. I was heavily involved, but there were a lot of terrific people. Rabbi Elephant joined the OU maybe 3 years after I came, something like that. So we had a terrific team of different people that, but together we created an amazing organization.
And I get to be benefit of it. We all get to benefit from all of the incredible work, creative work, hard work that went in to get us here today. We're so appreciative. One of the things we do is we do a series of rapid fire questions. I'm going to ask you a question based on today's Halacha Yomis, because I'm an avid reader. I know you know the answer, but I've asked a whole bunch of people today. And most people get it wrong. And the question is, what's the bracha on a mushroom?
Shahako.
Shahako. And why is that?
Because it doesn't draw nourishment from the ground.
I'm not going to talk about people in the room, who may have been making brachas for, a couple of decades, maybe more than that. And I don't know if I learned that before. I may have, but I think I was 0 days old when I first really saw that.
It's a good thing I got that right.
Yeah. When was the OU established? 1889, 1921. 1898, 1901.
1901?
98, you're close. Okay. Right off there. Where did the OU previously have an office? Italy, Ukraine, Russia, France?
None.
Ukraine.
Ukraine?
Yeah, back in the early 2000s in Kharkov. When did NCSY begin? 1940s, 1960s? 1950s, 1970s.
1950s?
Yeah, you got it. You must have some, I know you have some incredible stories over the year. There's the famous pizza story. I don't know if that's the one you want to tell, but can you share with us?
So I was besides being the, working for the AO, I was a rabbi in Edison, and there was a pizza shop under our supervision. And the I would go there in the evenings. I came home from the AO, I was there almost every day. It was Chol Yisrael, and I walked into the refrigerator. There was boxes of cheese, Chol Yisrael cheese, to all the way up to the ceiling, and everything seemed fine. And then after, probably about after a half a year, we took over the local vad, took over the pizza shop after Rabbi Raymond passed away. He was my predecessor. So I walked into the store, and there was a one of these large industrial cans called number 10 cans that had no label. And
like a silver can.
A silver can, yes. So the first thing, the quality you need to be involved in consciousness, you have to be suspicious. If you accept everything as it's probably okay, then you get a different job. So by nature, I try. When I'm dealing with people in my shul, I'm not suspicious, but when I'm dealing with kashrus, I have to be very suspicious. So why is there no label? So probably possibly the owner took it off because he didn't want me to know what was in the can. So I asked the owner what's in the can. He said it's green beans, and I knew it couldn't be green beans because engraved on the can it said product of Spain, and I don't remember seeing green beans coming from Spain. So I asked him to open the can. It was plums. So
is there a kashrus issue with plums?
There's no kashrus issue with plums, but he thought obviously that I wouldn't allow him to use canned plums without hechsher, so he took off the label. Okay, so I was upset that I knew that he was a devious person, but it bothered me as well. I had gone through the whole inventory. There were no other cans, and you don't buy one can, you buy a case. Where was the other can? So across the street from the store, there was an office that he had, and in a basement. And I thought maybe he's hiding the rest of the cans in the office, and who knows what else he has there. So I said, I want to go to the office. So he took me to the office. We went down a stairwell, and as he was fumbling for his keys to open the door, there were bags of garbage underneath the stairwell. And the best place to get information is from garbage bags.
You really are a detective.
That's right. I started looking at the garbage, and all of a sudden, the guy springs up. He sees I'm looking at the garbage. He runs over, grabs one of the bags of garbage, slings it over his shoulders, and darts up the stairs. And he's running away with a bag of garbage. What do? I have to run after him, obviously. So I was in hot pursuit. I ran up the stairs. I was much younger, so I was able to run as fast as he could. And he starts running down the main street in Highland Park, which is Raritan Avenue. And eventually, I caught up to him. And he, when he saw that I was almost next to him, so he darted behind the truck and he tried to stoop the garbage under the truck, and I took it out. And lo and behold, in the garbage bag were empty boxes of hard cheese, and it was obviously they weren't kosher. It was like George's cheese or something. So he said, "Oh, we don't use that. The garbage has been there for 10 years. It's not my garbage. Yeah, then why were you running away with it?" But I checked the expiration dates on the boxes, and it was like 6 months hence. So it was obvious that it was his garbage, and it was recently brought into the basement. So he was using.
Is there any truth to the rumor that somebody timed you running after him, and you set a world record?
But I wish that if they had cell phones, then they could have made a YouTube video of me running after. Holding on to my hat.
We can recreate it if you want.
That's right. We can have a movie. So it turned out that immediately I went to the store and said, "This supervision is terminated." But I spoke to the distributor, and they had decreased the amount of cheese they were buying from Ha'olam by 50% in the last year. So they were using half kosher cheese and half trefa cheese.
Wow.
The question is, how did he get into the store? Where was it? How come I never saw it? So after some investigation, which wasn't so easy because he threatened to murder me along the way, but that was only the first time I was threatened. A few times I was threatened. So what he did was, when in the pizza shop, when they buy hard cheese, they buy blocks of hard cheese, and they grate it and you use it as needed. But when the customer comes to the store, you don't start grating the cheese. You have it available, so sure. You grate it and you put it into tubs. So at night, when the store was closed, he came in late at night with boxes of trefa cheese, and he grated them, and he had them in tubs. So, and he made a mixture of kosher grated cheese and non-kosher grated cheese. So it taught me a very important lesson of how never assume anything when you're giving hashgacha. You always have to be suspect the worst, and you can't trust anybody. I mean, I thought he was an honest fellow, but obviously he wasn't.
We do a section called Turn the Table, where you get to ask me any question that you'd like.
Okay.
Mushrooms are shahakal.
What's your vision for the OU for the next 10 years?
It's a great question. It's a deep question. It's a lot. I talk a lot about, internally anyway, our culture. Communicating with each other and coordinating and collaborating and the three C's. And it's something I think it's not just for the workplace, for our headquarters, for our staff, for our participants, but globally. We have a representation opportunity, and we have a support opportunity for Jews and beyond, where communicating with them, sharing messages, some of the messages that Rabbi Hauer has been sharing recently, that everybody, really, that a lot of the
right,
leadership.
So the OU is really an organization for Klal Yisrael. So that's my question specifically, is in what way do you envision having more impact on not only internally, but I mean, obviously the stronger you are internally, the more you could do externally.
Right.
So what way you all use involved in so many different ways, in Kiruv and all the 18 different programs, but what new things do you envision for the OU?
So one
moving
is
forward
is to elevate the programs that we do have and the participants that we do have, and to make them get them people closer to Kadosh Baruch Hu, elevating their religious experience. There's no question about that, and to advocate for those who we haven't yet been as involved with. There are certain segments of the population that we haven't focused enough on, and to create new programs and new departments that are focused on those areas and those needs. So it's sort of a dual responsibility, both to grow the impact that we have in the current projects and to get to the areas where we have not yet been able to reach.
So I'll tell you how you have to be, you always have to think about what possibly could go wrong. There was a, when I came to the OU, there was a ice cream company that we certified, and one of the products they made was cookies and cream ice cream.
Yep.
So the manager of the plant called me and said he wants to purchase Oreo cookies to make Oreo cookies and cream. In those days, believe it or not, Oreos at one time were not kosher. They were.
I'm still upset we didn't make a yuntif on the day Oreos became kosher. That should be a day in everybody's year that we recognize
the
greatness of the OU for making Oreos kosher.
You could still do it.
Okay.
But in any event, so
you probably have the record somewhere of what day that was.
No. So the Oreos were clearly non-kosher because on the ingredient panel it said lard. So I said, so he wanted permission. He said he has a customer that wants to make Oreo cookies and cream ice cream. And he said he wants to buy Oreo cookies. He wants to bring them into the plant for that product. So I said, very nice. But how are we going to know that you're not using the Oreo cookies in the kosher ice cream? So he said, that's absurd. We would never use the Oreos for the kosher brand because the cookies that we use now for the kosher brand they're not a brand name and they're not expensive. But the Oreos, because it's a brand name,
sure,
like triple the price. So he said, we would never substitute them. So that sounded like made a lot of sense, right?
Makes sense to
makes
me.
Makes sense to
Case
me.
Case closed.
Yeah, that's it. So what happened was about a half a year later, a lady called me up and she said, I'm eating my ShopRite cookies and cream ice cream with an OU and there's an Oreo in there. Now, fortunately, Oreos, you could tell they're Oreos.
Stamp it.
Because it says Oreo, I mean, it was an Oreo piece. It wasn't a whole Oreo, but it was an Oreo piece. So I immediately called the company. I said, the lady told me that she found an Oreo in your ice cream. They said, I don't know, probably one of the workers grabbed an Oreo cookie off the shelf someplace, and then he only ate half of it and threw the other half into the vat. So, you know, so much for...
The health concerns,
health
I guess,
concerns.
Right? Yeah.
We went down to the plant. It was in Pennsylvania. And we came into the plant and we asked them if they have any OU cookies and cream ice cream in stock. And they said they do. We didn't tell them why we're asking. So I said, I'd like to see them. So we went into the cooler. They had a whole section with Oreo, with regular Oreo cookies and cream ice cream. We said, we want 10 boxes. So we took 10 boxes. We want to go to the laboratory. So we went to the lab. We opened, we tore open the boxes, turned on the hot water, and we melted the ice cream. And every single box had Oreo cookies and cream ice cream, or Oreo cookies. So the question was, why, what about that they would never
saving
do that?
Saving money, yeah.
Yeah, saving money. So nobody wanted to talk to us. They knew they were in very hot water. But we spent a few hours till we eventually found out what happened was the customer that was making Oreo cookies ice cream, they lost that account. And they were purchasing the Oreo cookies themselves for the customer. And when they lost the account, they had $25,000 of Oreo pieces that they couldn't use. They waited a month or two, and then there was going to be the expiration date was coming up. The cookies would get stale. They didn't want to lose all that money, so they started using them in the regular ice cream. They assumed, who's going to know the difference? So it taught me a tremendous lesson that this is Murphy's kosher law, that anything that could go wrong when it comes to kosher will go wrong.
And so how do you compartmentalize? On the one hand, you're a loving rabbi, amazing family, and you can't be suspicious of everybody around you, everybody you work with, everybody who you have as your balabata and people in your family. And yet when you come to work, you have to guess and second guess and triple guess. And how do you compartmentalize and not let that seep into your general
That's an excellent question. And I often have spoken about this at different presentations, that especially as a rabbi, you promote being dung a kaf schus and give people the benefit of the doubt. But when you're dealing with kashrus, you have to think differently. You don't know, but in every 1,000 cases of apples, there's some rotten ones. So there are people that are dishonest, mm-hmm. and there's numerous stories. I mean, I spend the whole day telling you a bunch of different stories, but there are people that are dishonest. So,
yeah.
you know, if when I'm dealing with a regular person, I'm not suspicious that they're, but I have to have in the back of mind that how do I know that? And unfortunately, even sometimes people who are Torah observant have done terrible things when it comes to kashrus. So you have to think of what. How do I know that this is true? Who said that what they're telling me is true? I have to independently verify whatever they're saying.
So that's a great bracha for us to learn from you as we close, to remember the good and look for the good, but also make sure that you're checking all the details in the places that you need to when you need to be so careful. It's a great bracha for us. For you as a role model, as an exemplar of this, to be mahalal, to praise all of your incredible work that you've done here, but also to be moda, to acknowledge, to thank you for all the stories and for teaching us and for building this incredible edifice, the structure, the people, and the neshama.
Thank you.
We thank you.
And you're doing a fantastic job as well.
Thank you so much.